We trust that everyone here tonight would be opening our hearts even more and more and more to Him and hearing what He has to say to us in this area. I was thinking, too, that we walk with a miraculous God, and He's a God that can heal us. He's a God that can cause all sorts of miracles. But frankly, I think one of the incredible things about the Christian life is a miracle of being able to get along with people you don't like. Because that's one thing Christianity offers and nothing else offers. Is how do you genuinely, genuinely love people, especially the ones that aren't easy to get along with, the ones you don't necessarily like. So we're going to talk about that tonight. My son, last night, I wasn't home, but he came running into the kitchen. He said, "Mommy, Mommy, I tied my shoes." Which was the first time he had ever tied his shoes. I tell you what, gang, that's a touching thing for a father. I mean, it's also a lot of time I'm going to save from now on out. But, you know, I was thinking about teaching your son to tie shoes. Have you ever tried to teach somebody to tie shoes? You know, you say, well, you hold your two strings like this, and then you wrap them around, and then you stick this... No. You stick this one under, and then you... Now, you pull them tight, and then you tell him to take this thumb and hold this first knot down. And while he holds this, puts pressure here, he takes this hand and somehow coordinates it to make a loop in this string, but transfers the pressure from his left hand to his right hand, wraps the string around with his forefinger, sticks the string through, keeping the pressure there somehow. He pulls the two loops apart, and it turns into a knot. Now, for those of you taking notes tonight, aren't you glad they created Velcro? And sometimes I think this area of how to get along with people is sort of like that. I think it's a lot like that. And so I may be a little naive coming along and offering some how to get along with people that you don't like. But since I have a lot of experience with people I don't like, and have kept careful notes and statistical analysis of those relationships over the last 15 years of my Christian life, I feel like I have somewhat of an authoritative word in this area of at least having people you don't like. I'm going to offer some things that I think are biblical and I think will help you with this area. Some of them you already know. The reason I say that, I'm going to ask you to turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. If you look at verse 9 and 10, Paul wrote this very young church. He'd been there a very short period of time, so he didn't have a chance to do an awful lot of follow-up with them. And yet he wrote an incredible thing I think ought to really encourage you and me. It certainly does me. But Paul wrote in verse 9, says, "Now as to the love of the brethren, now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write you, for you yourselves are," read it with me, "taught by God." Now, gang, you want to know what God is in the business of doing in your life tonight and what He'll be doing tomorrow and the day after and the day after that? One of the things He is teaching you in life is to love the brethren. He's doing that all the time. So if He's teaching us that, what should we be in the process of doing? Learning that. If I don't get anything else across tonight, let me encourage you to be learners. And you'll hear me say it over and over and over again. Learn, 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 learn how to do this. Because that's what He's in the process of doing, is teaching you. But He goes on to say, "For indeed you do practice it toward all the brethren." I think this group in particular, I'm not going to compare it. That's, I don't think, fair. But I think there's a genuine Christian love among you. There was among these Thessalonians. But he wrote them, he says, "But I urge you, brethren, to excel still more." Keep at it. Keep learning more and more and more about what's involved with loving people you don't like. My kids today, we dropped them off at Bobby and Gail's house for a few hours while Nancy and I ran some errands. And it was interesting. My son, when he first came into the house, the first thing he began looking for was the candy jar. And he found it. You know why he found it? There was something basic on his heart. Candy. Because that was what he was on, was what it was on his heart. That's what he was looking for. And because that's what was he was looking for, he found it. So gang, be like a kid looking for a candy jar when it comes to how to love people. We're looking at some things tonight. Let me define some terms just real quickly. What's the difference between loving people and liking people? And let me ask you this. I had my notes done up so that you have a minimum amount of note-taking. Is there anyone here that doesn't have that didn't get some? There should have been some in your... there's a couple back here. Mike, is this some extras? I tell you what, keep your hands up. I'm going to go ahead and start, but you'll be able to find me on these. And Mike, you might even want to have somebody else help you with that. But I wanted to be able to cover this relatively quickly without you having to lose a lot of it. What do we mean, the difference between loving people and liking people? Well, I'm not going to give a technical definition, but I think I come up with one that you and I can deal with. I think we all understand. Love is something that's a commitment. It's an act of the will. It's something that we do because there's an element of sacrifice to it. It's something we've determined to do. We've been commanded to do it, so we do it. That's what agape is. Liking is a little different, though. Liking is part of love. It's not like it's something different than love. It's a part of it. But liking is, when you think about it, it's more of an emotional thing. I was thinking about it this way. Loving someone, for example, you might have a friend. I mean, let me put it this way. You might not have a friend who is here tonight, though. Or who you're around all the time. Let's assume their mother was in a car accident. She lived in Washington. And so the BSU said, hey, let's raise some money so that person can fly back to Seattle to be with his mother. What would you do? Well, you'd probably chip in some money, wouldn't you? I mean, you love the guy. But tomorrow night's Friday night, you want to go out for pizza. Who do I go out for pizza with? Well, that's the last person I go out for pizza with. See, that's a little difference between loving somebody and liking someone. Loving someone is where you would sacrifice for them because you know you ought to. Liking somebody is where you enjoy being with them. There's that an emotional openness. You've accepted them. You received them in your life. Let me tell you some basic facts about people you don't like. First thing I've observed in my extensive study is that they're everywhere. They're everywhere. I mean, every place I've been, sooner or later, there's somebody there I don't like. And not only that, not only are they everywhere, but every group has at least one. You get in any group in life, any particular team or any particular Bible study or any particular church, and guess who's going to be there? And the third basic fundamental thing about people you don't like is that you are one of them. Somebody probably doesn't like you. And the fourth thing is beware of people you don't like. They may become your best friends. You may marry them. Nancy, where are you tonight? Nancy and I, when we knew each other for 6 or 7 years before we ever fell in love. We were joking about this, but those first 4 or 5 years, we did not like each other. We were in the same Christian organization, went to the same Bible studies, sat in on the same leadership team meetings. But she sat on that side of the table with her friends. I sat on this side of the room with my friends. And we were polite. But my impressions of her were not good. Her impressions of me were not good. We did not go out for pizza very often. But there were some things that changed. And I'm madly in love with that woman now. I think she likes me. So, why don't we like people? Well, very simply, I think there's two general areas. There might be three. You might add some things to this later. I hope you find some things. One is that we feel hurt by people. James 3:2, a simple verse, says, "For in many things we offend all." Well, that's not an excuse or a justification, but I think it's a fact of life. We do get offended by people. People hurt us. Our feelings get hurt. You hang around anybody very long, and sooner or later they will disappoint you, or you will disappoint them. So, in many things, you're going to be hurt by people. You see, every one of you has a variety of needs. Some of them are real, some of them are felt. When people meet your needs, you tend to like those people. You know, they make you feel like you're worth something. They make you feel needed. You like those kind of people, even if you're not around them much. But if people don't meet your needs, guess how you feel about them? Well, it's harder to like them because you don't feel like your needs met. Again, here's something for you to ponder on. We won't go into this in depth, but there's a need you have, and that's the need to be needed. The need to be needed. And when you don't feel people need you, it's harder to like those people, isn't it? Than the ones who really, 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 really need you. So it hurts. A second thing is what I put in my notes that you've got is perceived differences. Beside that, write perceived inferiority. It begins by us perceiving them, and the emphasis is on the word perception. It's how we think about things. It's what we think. And initially, we think of somebody as being somehow different. But we wind up then thinking of them as somehow inferior. And we tend not to like inferior people. Now, I've got this little chart below that I want to use as an illustration of that. The square illustration is me, okay, or you. The circle is them, whoever they are, some girl you don't like or some guy. Now, your life is simply made up of a variety of things. One is that you have been given a spiritual gift that has some characteristics to it, right? So, you have this particular gift. You've been given a personality that has certain traits. You have come through a certain background. Your parents valued certain things. You were maybe raised on the poor side of town or the rich side of town. You're maybe an Aggie or you're a lawyer, something like that. But you have a background. You've had a rough background, an easy background. You've got a unique background. Nobody else has that background. And you also have a degree of maturity that the Lord Jesus has brought about in your life through the working of His Spirit. And because His Spirit's working in your life, there's certain things you're strong in because He did that. But there's some areas He's still working in. Now, He takes that recipe and mix it up, and you come out with a square me. So, because you are a square, guess what you think everybody else ought to be? Squares. Now, other people have the same ingredients in their life. If they're a Christian, God's given them a spiritual gift with characteristics, but it may be different than yours. Their personality may be very different than yours, or it may be exactly like yours. But they've got a personality, they've got a background, they've got a degree of maturity, but they may be strong in other areas than you are. And so God has made them around. Now, you're a square, they're around, so there's this subtle assumption that because of that, I must be right. And if I'm right, then they're wrong. There's a subtle assumption that I must be better, and if I'm better, then they're inferior. And if that be the case, there's that subtle perception. I'm talking here about a perception that you're not even conscious of that says, I guess I don't need them because they're wrong and they're inferior. And so, they're not necessary to me. I can live without them. I don't like them. I can have my friends and do without them. And so we have a very limited appreciation and acceptance of those people. Again, around that square, I've jotted some dotted lines here to represent what I'm calling the fact that God is in the process of expanding your perception of other people, your appreciation of other people, and that's what He's in the process of doing. So that when you see somebody who isn't square like you are, you have enough understanding of life, understanding of yourself, and understanding of them that you can accept them. And that's what Romans 15:7 is all about. Wherefore, accept one another, just as God accepted, or just as Christ accepted us to the glory of God. Is that right? The word accept is what I'm after. And here's what that word means in the Greek. It's a very colorful word, and it's an emotional word. The word is this: accept, or welcome and receive to your hearts. Get that. Welcome and receive. Or take one another into your heart. Now let's think about that for a second. I want you to imagine that your heart, your soul, that personality that's you, is a living room. And you have a door through which you can let people into your life or keep them out of your life. Okay? Now, a lot of people, or at least we on the farm back up home, used to have little signs in our yard or signs over the door that said, welcome. Now, if you're a Christian, in essence, you have got a welcome sign on your life. And that welcome sign is John 15, 12, and 13. This is my commandment, that you love one another. Greater love has no one than this, than that you love one another. So that's what our life supposedly is all about. Loving people. That's our welcome sign. But what is it our emotions do? Well, with some people, our emotions, you know, we hear somebody at the door, and if we perceive them as somebody we value, somebody who is similar to us, we open our emotions up to them. We let them into the living room of our heart. Some people knock, and we see them, we perceive them as somehow being different, and so what do? We keep the door closed. We don't like them. Or somebody comes to the door of our lives. We meet somebody. They're in the BSU. They're in your Bible study or something like that. There's a potential of a relationship. And so you begin to open your life up to them. And then as they come in, you notice that they're tracking mud in on the carpet. They didn't scrape their shoes. So we politely and tactfully try to escort them back outside our lives because they didn't scrape their shoes. Well, gang, let me assure you of something. There's a storm going on in life. Nobody's perfect. Nobody has clean shoes, so to speak. You don't. And if you're going to limit your friendships to the people who you consider as ideal, or you're going to limit your life to the people that you like, you perceive as somebody you want to accept, if that's who you're going to limit it to, you're going to be falling far short of what God wants you to do as far as accepting one another. So I want to ask you this question tonight. Is the welcome sign on your life, that sign that says, love your neighbor as yourself, is that just some decoration on your Christian life? Or is that an invitation for people to come in? Again, as we look at this area, I want you to be encouraged. I found this quote the other day. Having a problem in a relationship does not indicate immaturity. Relationships, no matter how mature, are still prone to some kinds of conflicts. Having a problem in a relationship without dealing with it is immaturity. So what we're looking at now is, how is it that we really learn to like people? How do we get along with people we don't like? I'm going to skip this next section where it says, here's what God is up to in your life. I think we've basically touched on that. I'm going to introduce you to three people tonight that you may not like. And the first one is Larry Leader. Or for the girls, it might be Lana Leader. Now, let me describe this individual. I'll explain to you some of the problems this relationship could have, and then some of the solutions that I think God would give. In any given organization, like we've got a Baptist Student Union here, if it was Campus Crusade or a church or something, any kind of a Christian organization, there's an arrangement of or a system of leadership in that group. I mean, that's the way God designed things. That's for your spiritual protection. That's for instruction and example. It's for order and for organization. It's for counsel, direction. It's for intercession. Those people pray for you. So see, it's for your benefit. So, you're a growing Christian. You realize, you know something? I need somebody who's really helping me in the Christian life. I need a spiritual leader. I want a Paul, so to speak. Somebody that's really going to disciple me. So, you initiate this relationship with that person, or they initiate it with you. There may be a Bible study leader, a master life leader, or one of the directors here, a cell group leader, somebody. Maybe your pastor. Now, I've noticed three different phases that a person goes through when they're following a spiritual leader. And the first phase is what I'll call illusionment. Now, that's where you have this idea that this person is a pro. They know everything I need. They are spiritual. Man, they've got their act together. It's interesting. I don't know if John and Bobby had this experience or this thought, but I noticed when I came on staff here, everybody wanted to get time. G-I-T-I-M. Get time. I mean, they want to set up an appointment. And so you'd get time with people. Now, after you've been around for a year or so, people don't want to get time anymore. But they don't want to, not as many do. You know why? See, there were some expectations or some assumptions that you tend to put on this spiritual leader. You expect him to be something. I remember one time there was a pastor I worked for on his staff, and I knew of his grandfather who was a man of prayer. And so I said to this man, teach me to pray. Somehow I thought it came through the genes. And I went to learn to pray. And you know what he never taught me to do in those 3.5 years I was on staff there? He didn't teach me that. So see, I had an illusion. I had an assumption of what this person should be. So when you start finding out the facts about somebody, then you go into stage two. That's disillusionment. In other words, your expectations are not fulfilled to your satisfaction. Now you remember, they're your expectations. They're not necessarily God's. So, during this time of disillusionment, withdrawal sets in your soul. You know, your emotions. You don't like them as much as you thought you were going to. They aren't as great as you thought they were going to be. In fact, they're sort of ordinary. In fact, there's some things you know more about than they know. Anybody in that position right now? Well, withdrawal begins to take place in your soul. Here's some symptoms of it. First of all, you begin to resist their teaching. You become annoyed by their supervision, like, who do they think they are overseeing my life? I ought to be leading them. They need detailed instruction. And so, in other words, you're withholding your creativity, you're withholding your spirit from them, and so, okay, you want me to do this, give me the details. You have shallow obedience, shallow cooperation. There's a loss of enthusiasm. You take things personally when they're trying to help you with some things. And you begin listening for other people that are disillusioned with Larry Leader. And you start talking about them. Well, I think there's a solution for that, or at least I have, and that's a third stage in that relationship. I'm going to call it enlightenment. Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians 5, why don't you just let me read it, and I'll save you having to look it up. But he told us how we are to think about spiritual leaders. See, we're talking here about how we perceive them, what we understand. Verse 12 says, but we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you. It didn't say that they have to be greater than you or know everything. Or that they even have to know. They don't have to be the Apostle Paul. He said, but I tell you, if you're going to follow somebody, appreciate them, because they have charge over you in the Lord, and they give you instruction. It wasn't your option, it was God's option God was the one that made that arrangement. It's the Lord's relationship. So you show appreciation, and it says in verse 3, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. So let me give you a couple of things that I think will help you in developing esteem for them. One is to see yourself as a servant rather than the one being served. You remember the story in John 13 about Jesus had his disciples up in the upper room and they're up there eating the Last Supper and having this tremendous time together. See, there's two basic responses to the need. There may have been an awareness of a need. And that was that they hadn't washed their feet yet. Well, you've got one guy maybe sitting on one side of the room going, stinks in here. It stinks in here. Somebody didn't wash their feet. Now, that's one way of responding to a problem. It stinks in here. Or you can be like Jesus, who quietly got up, got his towel, his basin, quietly began serving and meeting the need. Do you see yourself that way towards your Bible study leader, your master life leader, your pastor, the staff here? A second thing is to see yourself as a learner. You remember Harold Bullock told us that if you're really hungry, any plastic fork will do. See yourself as a learner. Because gang, here's something I've realized over the last few years, and that growth comes more from your teachable spirit than it does from the expertise of your teacher. So you concentrate on learning, and you let God teach through them. So Larry Leader is one person you may not like. There's another person, and that's Paul Peer. And I chose these names not to imply anyone, but just because they rhymed. Or for the girls, it may be Paul Appear. And here's who Paul Appear is. They're not your leader. They're not necessarily somebody who you're working with or discipling in Christian life. They're somebody who's basically your age. They're involved with the ministry. They're maybe in your Bible study, your master life group. They're kind of about the same level or maybe on ministry team, something like that. And they're just one of the gang. And they haven't necessarily done anything wrong to you. See, the problem with Paul Peer is that you don't like him. The problem also is that you can't avoid him. They're around all the time. So how do you get along with people you don't like Paul Peer? Well, you all know that with some people, your relationships really click. Is that the word, click? Beware of those dating things, though, that start off and all they do is click. They can clash and crash as fast as they click. There needs to be something more solid there than that. I think that same thing is basically true of the friendship. But some things really click. Sometimes there's a real clash. Now, why is it that we clash with people? Well, I've talked to you a little bit about that. There's this, and we perceive them a certain way, and so if we perceive them as being different enough, we begin to close our spirit to them. And so I basically recited some of that here. But here's some of the reasons that we turn ourselves off, we close our emotional door to Paul Peer. You know, one of our potential friends. One is there may be a physical difference. We maybe see there's something about them that annoys us, or we don't like that, or we don't like the way they look, or maybe a handicap or something like that. So we close ourselves emotionally. Sometimes it's their spiritual maturity. We feel like, come on. You ought to know such and such and so by now. I mean, you've been through Mastermind. Come on, grow up. Get on with the program. Now, you see those people, and if they're different than you, and you are one way, you don't particularly care for the deep people, and the deep people don't care for the party people, and the, come on, let's get on with the program, have a hard time with the type. There's going to be a clash. And you've also got different backgrounds. We've already talked about that. But you begin to see that person then as inferior, and then you, like I've mentioned, you begin to say, I don't need that person. And when you don't need people, why like them? You don't have to open your heart to them because you don't need them. And here's what happens over time. You're in this... See, the awkward thing about Paul Pierce, like I said, you can't get away from this person. You see him every Sunday at ministry team. You see him every Tuesday night in your Bible study. Every Thursday night at Vespers. And then Sunday at Sunday school. I mean, you're around him. And yet down in your soul, you just... I could do without that person. So here's what begins to happen. You try to do subtle things to get them to straighten out. Now, straighten out means you're trying to get them to conform to what you think is right. Or you may be trying to get them to conform to what's right. But you go about it in a real subtle way, dropping hints. Along with that, you're beginning to justify yourself by proving to yourself that you're the best, you're the right. You're going through this mental gymnastics. You're assuring yourself that, hey, I'm really the one that's right. My temperament's better. And you're also keeping a mental list of their flaws. I mean, you can recall them all. With other people that maybe have noticed the same flaws, it's as if you can sit in your dorm room with a big screen on in full color reviewing the flaws of Paul up here. If you're close enough to this person, in other words, they're involved in the same group, after a while you're going to have little confrontations. They're not big fights necessarily, but just little spats, clashes. But the sad thing is that after a while, one of them sooner or later dominates the other. And that's not Jesus. It's not Jesus at all. That's flesh. Now, let me assert something here. If you don't like Paul Pier, whoever that might be, keep in mind that the clash you're having with them isn't because they have done something wrong to you. They've just been being them. You're the problem, not them. The problem is your perception of them, your acceptance of them, or your rejection of them. The problem is you, not them. So you ask, but yeah, this guy or this girl has a definite character flaw. Well, we're not saying we're justifying character flaws, but what we're talking about here is, are we willing to accept somebody even if they haven't, like I said before, scraped their shoes? 1 Thessalonians 5 says this, 14 and 15, I believe the passage is, it says, if somebody's done something wrong, admonish the unruly. If they've got sin in their life, admonish them. If they're faint-hearted, encourage them. If they're weak, let me help me. Admonish the unruly, encourage the faint heart, help the weak. But no matter who they are or what their flaw is, be patient with all men. So you do not have the right to reject that person. Here's some things that I found to be helpful as I go through these in life. One is seeking to get to know people better. Let me share a passage with you. Philippians 1, 9, and 10. I want to share it out of J.B. Phillips. Other translations are equally as rich, but Phillips has a way of really colorfully translating the Greek, and he says, my prayer for you is that you may be still have still more love. Okay, now listen carefully. You want to have still more love? A love that is full of knowledge and wise insight. You want to really learn to love people? Grow in knowledge and insight. I don't know about you, but I keep a file on this sort of stuff because I want to learn more and more about people and how they operate so I can show love to them. See, people are sort of like keys on a key ring. I've got some basic insight and knowledge about the keys in my life, about the locks in my life. This one gets me in my car door. It's the only one that gets me in my car door. And so I have to treat my car door and my ignition differently than I treat the BSU. But once I'm in the BSU, I have to treat my office differently than I did the back door. Because you see, each lock has a slightly different key, and I've got to have knowledge and insight as to which key fits which lock. Again, that's what knowledge and insight, knowledge and wisdom does for you in relationships. People are all different. And caring for them and showing love for them, liking them, means that you may have to have several different insights about how people operate until you find that right one that lets you into their heart and lets them into yours. So grow in knowledge and insight. Get to know them better. I'm amazed at when I get to know people how much I like them. I'm amazed that when a summer came along that I got to know Nancy Pickett, I fell madly in love with her. What was the difference? Had she changed? No. My perception became accurate instead of inaccurate. What's going to happen with you and your friends, the people you don't like? Another thing is ask God to show you your need for that person. You don't need people. You don't like them. But if you need them, you're going to start opening your soul. Here's some things I do. I'll sit down and I'll write down a list of the benefits of the relationship. It sheds real light on things. I also realize that seeing my need may take time. And so I work at being patient. And realize that you may have to go through some hard, humbling experiences in this relationship. But as the Lord takes you through those times, and as you learn from those times, you'll gain insight into that person. The bottom line is this. Don't be foolish and hope that this relationship with Paul Peer goes away. That isn't the Christian way of doing things. You get before God. You find out what you need to do to demonstrate to that person you genuinely love them with your heart. Now, we've talked about who? Larry Leader and who else? Paul Peer. There's one other person you may not like, and that's Sidney so-and-so. Now, here's the difference between Sidney and Paul. Paul was just one of the people around your peer group. But he hadn't necessarily done something wrong to you. It's just you didn't care for him. You maybe had the spiritual gift of irritation. But Sidney is a little different. Sidney may be a peer. Sidney could be anybody. But what Sidney has done, Sidney so-and-so, is that Sidney has done something wrong to you. Now, guess how you tend to feel towards people that do wrong things to you? You don't like them, do you? Your emotions close up, don't they? Now, you may love them enough that if a crisis came along, you'd sacrifice for them, but you sure don't enjoy them. You haven't welcomed them. Here's what happens. See, they do something that hurts you, so your feelings are affected. That leads to anger. Now, if you don't deal with anger, right then and there begins to brood, begins to fester. And Hebrews says it's like a seed that begins to root, and you don't see the roots at first. You're only occasionally aware of roots. But then one day it pops up, that root of bitterness. And you're bound by it. And not only that, but it begins to destroy other people. And so that's the problem that you face with Sidney so-and-so, is you've become bitter towards him. And to a large extent, at least in my experience, when I look back over the bitternesses I've had to deal with, they've been problems of exaggeration in my own mind. I exaggerated the problem. Let me try to illustrate it this way. Let's assume this rock represents a relationship, okay? No, pardon me. This rock represents a situation, some circumstance. Now, for Sydney or Cindy, so-and-so, for them, it was a situation. But because of the way they handled themselves in that situation, it's as if they took this thing and launched it. And it hit you square in the center of the forehead. Now, for them, there's a situation. How do you feel about it? You got knocked cold by what they did. But it was the same situation. Now, they may not realize what they did. If they do realize it, they probably have only a fraction of the sense of the pain that you're aware of. And here's the way bitterness works. Bitterness takes that situation, you know, when it's falls down there, and so you start looking at that situation instead of to your Father in heaven. And it becomes this intensity. It's like the ninth inning. The bases are loaded. You're the pitcher. The count is 3-2. It's the last pitch of the ballgame. And so you see that situation. And you see Sydney out there. And you look to your left. And you look to your right and make sure nobody's watching. And you rear back with that thing and you deck him with all you've got. Now, you may never do it with your words. You may never do it with an action, but you're doing it in your mind. And you are bound and dominated by this bitterness. This, I will get even. Let me share some indications of bitterness. Bitter people withdraw spiritual fellowship from the people they're bitter towards. They can have polite conversation over dinner, but there's no fellowship. There's shallow conversation normally. You tend to find faults with them because that's what you're looking for. And then there's an inner delight in their failure. You all experience that? And then comes giving and receiving negative reports. Rumors is what that means. It starts out subtle. You know good and well you shouldn't be doing it, and so you cloak it in spiritual language like you're trying to figure out how you can pray better. But in your soul, what's really... Pause to stare. In your soul, you know good and well what you're doing. You know good and well what you're doing. You're simply wanting somebody else to agree with you. You even go so far as to subtly guide conversations so that it winds up talking about Sydney. And here's another indication I found in my life. If I'm bitter towards somebody, I can't get them off of my mind. They're always coming back to mind. In fact, I'm kind of afraid I'll bump into them. But I'm possessed by it. Well, I know some of you can identify with that because you told me in the last couple of weeks that you could. So, what do you do? Well, the key to overcoming bitterness is forgiveness. But it's understanding what forgiveness really is. The idea of forgiveness is not just saying, oh, I'm sorry, it's all in the past. Let's let bygones be bygones. That doesn't work. Jesus told us in the last verse of Matthew 18 that when you forgive somebody, it's not just something you do with your head. He says, forgive your brother from your heart. Your emotions have got to have a part in it. It's got to start with your mind, but your emotions, you've got to free that person. Because forgiveness, the Greek word, is very simple. It means to release or to set free. Colossians 3:13 would imply this definition. It's releasing a person from the just penalty for his offense toward you. Yes, he did do something wrong. but you're releasing them from the penalty of that. But you're not only saying, oh, that's okay, let's let bygones be bygones, leave it in the past. You're also searching for understanding and wisdom to release him from the cause of his offensive ways. You're trying to think through, how is it now that I minister to that person? It's like a knot in a rope. You can't just take a rope with a knot in it and just say, I'm going to straighten this thing out, and you start pulling. It won't come out. You've got to figure out, now, how is it I release this knot? How do I set it free? And each knot may be different. But that's what forgiveness is. I knew of a situation in the past, in another place we lived, somebody did me wrong. And it's amazing how I faked myself out. I told myself, it's okay, I can handle it. See, that's not forgiveness. And so guess what happened for the next year? It festered. Whenever I'd get a call from people who lived there, I'd want to hear about so-and-so, hoping that something was going wrong in their life. We got to Glen Eyrie, and I heard a lot and learned a lot at Glen Eyrie, but you know what God did for me at Glen Eyrie? Is he put his finger on that bitterness. He says, Dave, you haven't forgiven them from your heart. And that week I said, Lord, I forgive them. Totally. I was aware of a freedom, a new dimension in ministry. I've been able to share with other people. God's been able to work through that situation. And if they called on the phone tonight, I could honestly say, I am glad you called. See, I like them. I really like these people. I like them. So, some practical considerations. Release them from your emotional prison. 1 Corinthians 13:5, love does not take into account a wrong suffered. It's not doing bookkeeping. Don't put it off. Ephesians 4:6 says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. Gang, it is easier to forgive one sin now than 6 months worth of bitterness later. It's easier to deal with that sin tonight than it is 6 months from now. Because it doesn't go away. It's constantly growing and increasing. Let God teach you all he can through the experience. In essence, let God just tap on your shoulder and teach you lessons from this. Find thoughtful ways of showing your love for them. I say thoughtful things. Don't do corny things like, okay, I love them now. I'll send them a Christmas card. But you find out, you know, what is that person's unique need? What's a unique interest? If they have something against you, it may be such that you have to wait. But you're thinking, how do I meet their needs? See, your mind has changed to concerning yourself for them rather than just for yourself. And then, gang, something practical I've learned, and that is that don't put deadlines on their changing. They may never change. But Jesus told Peter in Matthew 18, he says, don't matter if you forgive them 7 times, you go ahead and forgive them 70 times 7. You just keep forgiving them from your heart. What have we said tonight? What have we said tonight? Well, back to the illustration I said before about the door in your heart. Gang, there's a storm going on out there in people's lives. Everybody has some mud on their shoes. Nobody is perfect. And if you are going to have any kind of meaningful friendships and Christian relationships with people, you're going to have to accept people for who they really are. Assets and deficits. And I ask you tonight, is the front sign on your life, which is welcome, i.e. love your neighbor as yourself, is it there just as a decoration? Or is it something that you can honestly say, I invite you into my life? Those Larrys, those Pauls, and those Sydneys. Well, Romans 15:7 says, wherefore accept and welcome and receive to your hearts, take one another into your lives. If Paul were to write a letter to you and me tonight, to this particular group of people, I think he could say, like he did to the Thessalonians, Now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. For indeed you do practice it towards all the brethren who are at OU. But I urge you, brethren, to excel still more. Still more. You know, Tina sang a song tonight, and one of the phrases, he was just a simple carpenter with healing in his hands. And as she sang that, I really believe in the power of God to bring about healing. I really believe in the power of God to move mountains. But as I've tried to assess the Scripture, as I've tried to assess human lives, the conclusion I have to come to is the greatest miracle, greater than the healing of a human body, is the healing of a relationship. Because the forces driving a relationship apart are far greater than the forces causing a wind on a sea that needs to be stopped. And you let Jesus be a healer, a simple carpenter with healing in his hands, and you become someone who's learning more and more and more about how to get along with people you don't like.